Hello, I'm Allegra Stratton and welcome to Politics Weekly. Well, through our glass studio window we can see the paper's morning conference in full swing, but I have managed to pull out three of the Guardian's greatest. We have Julian Glover, who's the leader of Leader Writers, Deborah Hargreaves, who informs me she is obsessed with class warfare, more of that later, and Polly Toynbee, who's come straight from the CASP Business School. Good morning all. Now, pity for Sir Fred's Edinburgh Villa, Debs, or not?
It's hard to feel sorry for Sir Fred. It really is. He's shown no remorse. He's given up nothing. He's not given up his money. He's not disappeared away to run a charity or given all his pension to
I suppose
charity.
The surprise is why hasn't happened earlier.
I suppose that's true. But, I mean, we're going to see a lot more of it in the next few days.
Polly, what's next week going to be like?
I think it's going to be a totemic moment. The toll tax riots, it just took, you know, one guy, a seminal photo, throwing a scaffolding pole, and it looked like revolution. It was quite a small number of people, but highly politically motivated. It doesn't take a lot to change public mood.
Julian, revolution starting next week.
No, not quite. Revolution deferred. I think people are subdued, they're depressed, they're gloomy, they're very frightened. I don't think they're rebellious yet. I think there's a small number of people.
They're angry.
They're cross, but they're not going to go onto the streets. There'll be protesters, the same sort of people who protested at the height of globalisation as well. I don't think this is yet a national mood in the way the poll tax was. I think there's just an utter depression.
We will pick this part a bit more later, but for now, right as we speak, Gordon's in Brazil shaking the tin for his fiscal stimulus plan. It's only one leg of an odyssey he's embarked on to drum up support for next week's G20. He'd barely left Heathrow when the governor of the Bank of England opened fire. No more fiscal stimulus, he said, you just can't afford it. Well, that was just one of a series of terrible bits of news for GB this week. For all the gruesome detail, Debs is going to give us a fill on the economy's bad week.
Well, it's been a real week in the economy, it really has, and Mervyn King's comments stand out. Vince Cable, of course, says he launched a coup and drove his tanks down to Westminster. He is right, though. We can't afford much more fiscal stimulus, and you've seen the public finances in such poor shape. The deficit is now 75 billion and it's forecast to rise even more, could go as high as 10% of national income, which would be 150 billion. And the Bank of England is worried. We saw that with the first failed gilts auction this week, which is the first time that not enough investors have bought government debt for 7 years. If that happens again, it could be a one-off, but if it happens again, it's going to make it very difficult to finance this burgeoning deficit. Of course, we've had inflation figures out this week, which have surprised the city, given that inflation actually rose slightly. That's the consumer price index. The other measure of inflation, retail price inflation, fell to zero. That was expected to go below zero and could still do that, showing that we're heading into a deflationary period.
Together, terrible. Which is the worst, if you had to pick?
I think Mervyn King's comments are probably the worst. I mean, Gordon really could have done without that, and particularly coming when they did, just as he embarked on his world tour.
Polly, has he overstepped the mark?
Absolutely.
The governor's supposed to do that.
It's outrageous. This is the man who got it really wrong. Wrong compared to the ECB, wrong compared to what the Americans were doing. You know, he was really wrong-footed. Why do we think he's right now? It's a very odd political gesture. I think we're seeing a lot of this now.
And it
now.
Was intended. It wasn't sort of over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course it was. These people know they have to be incredibly careful with every word that they speak. What we're seeing now, and this is happening right across all sorts of sectors, anybody at all dependent on government in any way at all, a sort of swing towards conservatives and an eye towards what they think will be a conservative future. I think it's quite interesting if you look at all kinds of political positioning that's going on amongst people like this in Quangos and other places, a leaning towards saying things that please Cameron and Osborne a lot.
Julian, is that fair?
Well, it's true that the Independent Bank of England is showing independence. Of course, we know who created the Independent Bank of England. It was the Prime Minister. And there is a difficulty for Gordon Brown and his friends at about attacking Mervyn King for being wrong and taking the wrong policy, which is, of course, that Gordon Brown was also wrong and took the wrong policy. Mm. So the two of them are going down together. They're clearly on terrible terms. I think they've been on terrible terms ever since Gordon Brown became Prime Minister. Some people say that the Prime Minister didn't speak to Mervyn King for the first year of his office. I think that's pretty irresponsible on both sides.
But in terms of the shift to the Tories, Osborne said this week will come to be a week of reckoning. Is that just sort of the hysteria of opposition and they have to say things like that? Or do you think he's got it?
it's clearly the language of opposition. You always exaggerate things. Politics exaggerates things. I don't think the Tories think something this week is going to change the world, change British politics.
It's a bad week.
But
right?
It's a very bad week for the government. I mean, we get to the point with Tony Blair, of course, when we always used to say this is the worst week, and then Alastair Campbell would tell us, but you've had three worst weeks this month. You can't have another one until May. But with Gordon Brown, what the Tories feel is happening, and they don't think the public are yet noticing this, but they feel confident themselves that a year ago, late October, there was a feeling that the Tories were very, very lonely. Nobody said anything like them on the economy around the entire world. They had to kind of look to the most obscure countries. They went through the yellow pages trying to find an economist somewhere that thought they were right. And Gordon Brown was a hero. He was going to get the Nobel Prize and everything had been rescued and it was amazing. What's happened now is the Tories actually seem to have quite a lot of friends. And maybe that's partly just crude politics, as Polly says. People look like they're going to win. But suddenly Stephen Byers pops up and says, oh, yes, you're right on the VAT. Governor of the Bank of England comes before the Treasury Committee and sort of backs them a bit, maybe not directly, on bonds and borrowing. And they seem to have lots of friends. They're saying things that look like they're in the mainstream. Meanwhile, Gordon Brown looks like he's not in the mainstream. He has got the President of America, so that's quite a big friend.
But he does something else he's got, which is
well,
very...
Well, he doesn't have France or Germany, and that's a big
problem.
Well,
he does, because what's so extraordinary and bizarre is that Germany talks one way, walks another. Germany has actually had a bigger fiscal stimulus than we've had, and yet they keep saying, no, we're not. I think it's partly because they're a split government, and so they're ideologically sort of all over the place,
partly because they're pretending to their own. His relationship with the German finance minister, who gave an interview the other day mocking Brown for calling for EU reform now, when Brown, he said, I remember sitting in a villa in Essen with Gordon Brown and I suggested openness for hedge funds in 2007. This was not a long time ago. And Gordon Brown actually stormed out the room and humiliated them. And there was no openness for hedge funds because of Gordon Brown. And the Germans don't like him on that. And the Tories are building links there. And that is partly politics, it's partly economics as well.
The Germans also have this very strong concern about inflation, which is obviously built into their past and, you know, the Weimar Republic and everything. And they are very concerned that if we rush too far into an even bigger fiscal stimulus, then we are prompting inflation in the future, which could well be a problem.
In terms of what could have been done had there not been fiscal stimuli, what would October of last year, what would, if he hadn't gone for 20 billion, obviously there's sort of questions about whether it should have been a VAT cut or not, but the idea we can be sitting here now and talking about whether that was a good idea, that's madness, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always really easy to talk about these things with hindsight. In October last year, we were days, hours away from the collapse of the banking system. The government had actually discussed a plan to turn off all the cash points. Can you imagine if that had happened? I mean, it was a knee-jerk reaction, we say now, but there was no other option, and you had to support those banks. We could not let a bank fail in early October. I mean, and something had to be done in a real rush. Now there's time for greater reflection, and I really think, you know, you can plan a little bit more. And it probably is difficult to pump more money into the economy. We've already got the Bank of England printing money, so it is time for a bit more sober reflection, I think.
What about David Blanchflower though? I mean, there he is saying we desperately need a stimulus. We desperately need an FDR type program, particularly for kids. 600,000 kids leaving school this summer into an abyss. Kids who may never be rescued again and whose children will grow up dysfunctional too. That is a real emergency. That's a real investment in our future. It's a real debt. We're also hanging on to future generations. We have to find the money to do it. Blanchflower says we can and should, and it's more important than worrying about the size of the debt at the moment.
We really do have to do something about young people. I agree with that. And there is this sort of huge generational divide out there, and there does have to be something targeted at youth unemployment. It's absolutely right. And inequality. What you have to do to pay for that is to raise taxes on high earners, ban bankers' bonuses. You know, you've got to do something to pump money back into the economy from the top.
You've also got past to have a Prime Minister who has the courage to be quite commanding. I think he should start doing things like addressing the nation directly. I just frankly find it astonishing he's gone to Brazil this week rather than talk to the country when the country would quite like to hear from him. He didn't even turn up at Prime Minister's questions. But more than that, he could find the money, and youth unemployment, the role of youth, it's a terribly important issue. I don't sense much from the government on it. Ed Balls kind of goes on about diplomas, but there is no sense of any minister taking this issue. They could save money from Trident. They could could save money for my identity cards. They could do a bit of tax raising, perhaps not too much. You can't talk about having a big fiscal stimulus and
put taxes
up at the same
time. Trouble is, they don't make much money, so we're not spending on Trident yet. No. And we're not spending on ID cards. An awful lot's already been spent.
Yes.
It's not clear. If you actually need cash in hand now because you don't dare borrow anymore, neither of those quite deliver.
What about cutting the salary of everybody for the public service who earns more than £100,000?
Yes, and if we did that...
If
we did that alongside, you know, snaffling all bonuses, simply confiscate them.
Yes, of course. Well, but to the extent that, I mean, one of the things still very well going about bonuses, there aren't going to be any bonuses in the city this year.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised. There will be bonuses. There's always an area that performs well enough to pay out.
Bonuses, as Gordon Brown pointed out a couple of years ago, are taxed. So there is some money from bonuses. They aren't just invisible money. They are income too.
At the lowest rate in the EU, except for Luxembourg.
Certainly,
which is
I think that higher rate taxes will have to go up. But money can be found. But the government doesn't seem to be finding it.
Next week, we've had G8, G7, G20 meetings before, and we've had huge demonstrations. Isn't there a chance that next week's could yield more because you have the establishment actually for the first time quite close to those who are protesting in terms of changes they want to see? What do you think will happen next week, Polly?
I think there will be a lot of noise. I think there are always ready sort of small revolutionary movements who, if they see an opportunity, socialist workers or whoever they may be, anarchists of one kind or another, will get out there. I think it works because there is a huge head of anger. I mean, at this Cass Business School breakfast I was at this morning, there were a couple of guys who'd been on talk radio and on phone-ins and were absolutely shell-shocked at what they got back. I mean, they just said they'd never had such a kicking like it in their life. They were absolutely appalled at the rage out there. I mean, just wave after wave.
Talk of bankers hanging from trees on Radio 4.
That's absolutely right. And you feel that these protesters are now supported by Middle England. I mean, my parents and their friends, they're all talking about this. Everyone out there, every sensible person. And we've had a series this week of attracting other voices into the paper to go with our G20 articles. Every one of those people, from teenagers to pensioners to teachers, they are far more radical than any politician. Obviously, they have the freedom to be radical, but there are people out there who really want our politicians to come up with radical ideas to address this, and something that captures that anger. And I think we need to think very seriously about what we do on top pay, and we need to address inequality.
Okay, well, that was the pre-match chat. Next week, the day after the G20, members of the Guardian political team will be here to dissect it. We've got Johnny Friedland and Larry Elliott. Well, while Brown was abroad, back home, the government were trying to get on with legislation as normal. This week, Jack Straw set out plans to bring a new Bill of Rights, building on the existing Human Rights Act. Alan Travis unpicks it for us.
This is a green paper, it's a consultative paper, and he's talking about having a Bill of Rights and Responsibilities. First of all, he said he's not going to repeal the Human Rights Act, nor resile from that at all. That's quite an important statement to make in the current party political atmosphere, where there's a lot of speculation about what the government and the Conservatives might do with the Human Rights Act. He wants to build on the Human Rights Act, and he wants to enshrine explicitly a series of rights and responsibilities which are, as he puts it, scattered throughout the landscape of our legislative framework, constitutional world. So, for example, he's talking about enshrining economic and social rights, such as the right to free access to health treatment, as has been there since 1948. Now, what he's not saying, though, is be able to go to the High Court and legally enforce these rights through a judge. Now, alongside that would be a whole bunch of responsibilities as well, such things like the right to vote, right to pay taxes. Now, they also wouldn't be legally enforceable. So, for example, he's not going to introduce a compulsory duty on everyone to vote, but he wants to enshrine in the Bill of Rights the right to vote, the duty to vote, so that it becomes a feeling of civic duty, the acclamatory statement.
Gillian, you've got Gordon in Brazil, you've got Straw on rights. What are they up to?
Well, it's strange. This Bill of Rights thing is something that every party says it wants. Each party now, each of the three main parties, proposes
the Bill of Rights and Responsibilities.
A Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, because Gordon Brown always has to have two bits to a sentence, so it's this and that. So all the parties say they want one. All of them have got different versions, and nobody quite knows why or what it's for. The Tory version seems to be a disguise for getting rid of the Human Rights Act. The Labour version... well, it was a little bit of that at times. There was a bit of, we don't quite like the Human Rights Act, let's just sort of rebrand it and bury it. which I think is a pity. I think the government should support the Human Rights Act in public. I think it should be much more open about it. I don't think we need a new version of it.
But this, I mean, you heard Alan, he's saying not enforceable in the courts. This is just a list of nice things.
Well, some of the rights are enforceable. The responsibilities are bizarre, you know, parenting. I mean, why do we need the government to tell people that they should be good parents? People presumably ought to be good parents. They want to be good parents. They might need help to be good parents. They don't need to be told by a piece of paper. It is quite bizarre. And I'm afraid it is partly the shallowness of a lot of Gordon Brown's thinking that he has all sorts of initiatives and ideas and buzzing bits of his soul about changing the context of our society. And in some ways, that's quite admirable. But when it comes down to the detail, it never exists. He's had all sorts of schemes like this, and they don't happen. And anyway, this isn't going to happen because it's only for something after the election, which they're not going to win.
Right. Debs, economic rights, how does that work?
Well, I just think this whole rights thing is completely ridiculous. It does have the real feel of fiddling while Rome burns, don't you think? I mean, you know, what's wrong with the Human Rights Act enshrined? You know, that's enshrined in law. We don't need anything else to tell us. I agree with Julian. I just think it's a nonsense.
Polly, if you're in, I don't know, Worcester or wherever, do you care that the government has said this on rights, or are you thinking,
no,
I'm worried about unemployment?
No, I think that this is Jack Straw populism. Most unpleasant things that he's said, where he very carefully, because he's got a good lawyer's mind, he very carefully places the idea that he thinks the Human Rights Act is a bad idea, pleases the Daily Mail, gets a Daily Mail front page, but he doesn't actually say he's going to undermine it. And I think it's that sort of positioning that he's up to. This is a meaningless green paper going nowhere. But it does come out as something quite deep within Gordon Brown that he's now given up because he hasn't got time. That whole Britishness riff, it wasn't purely, I'm a Scot, get me out of here. But it came from something, I think, utterly misguided and absurd. A genuine sense that out there, people no longer know what kind of country we are. I mean, France has been going through this. A lot of countries have been going through sort of existential angst about not knowing who they are. And he's much too inept to do it. He doesn't have the language. He doesn't have the skill. He doesn't have a way of describing one nation, we're all in this together, in the right kind of language. But it came out of that sort of feeling, and this is the miserable little mouse it's produced at the end of the day.
I once said to one of the ministers involved, I said, you know, why are you doing it? It is sort of beside the point. And they said, well, actually, this was slightly cynical, but they said, if you look at lots of swing seats where they are fighting the Lib Dems, this is classic. They will love this because the Lib Dems are very good on civil liberties. The government's not so good. Do you think there is some strategy there, or this is just simply... Well, we were trying to do this for ages.
The
Let's
idea
get it
this
done.
Government could beat the Lib Dems on civil liberties is kind of or ridiculous. Or the idea that there are going to be any one single seat that is swung on civil liberties, I would be amazed. Yeah. Absolutely amazed. I think there is something there, though, that will come into the manifesto about giving people actual rights to certain services. And I think that's brewing for the manifesto, and it will be quite specific.
The real pity out of this is that Gordon Brown likes dividing lines in politics, and there is a dividing line, which is Labour introduced and supports the Human Rights Act, and the Tories didn't introduce it and proposed to get rid of it. It's a very clear line, and if the government wants something to campaign on, to defend itself, and to make the Tories look a bit extremist, certainly dangerous, and all over the place, because nobody knows what they want in its place, it's already there. They don't need this to do it.
And Julian, on that, have you seen a shift in Tory policy with Grayling becoming Shadow Home?
The Tories have always disliked the Human Rights Act. I think they're becoming a bit more strident in their language. Cameron certainly seems to be more hostile to it. I don't think it's a fundamental change because they've never really wanted to have it in the first place.
Well, if this is the kind of topic that gets you screaming at your computer, listening to your podcast, then you can find out much more on government plans to shore up civil liberties at www.guardian.co.uk/commentersfree/libertycentral. For a man who likes hush puppies, Mr. Ken Clark has been a very noisy old dog indeed. The Tories brought him back to add some ballast to their shadow cabinet team, but since then, more inexperienced members have spent their days, quotes, clarifying his remarks. Simon Hoggart explained.
Well, of course, David Cameron took a great risk when he brought Ken Clark back into his shadow administration. The point about Ken is that he doesn't mind what he said, provided he believes it to be true. Anyway, David Cameron brought him into the shadow cabinet to give a bit of heft and weight at a time when he clearly needed it, and it's already led to problems and to great delight for Gordon Brown. It's been one of the few pieces of good news he's had over the past few weeks because Ken Clark agrees with him on several things. He said he thought the VAT cut was rather a good idea, though it's looking pretty ropey now. Of course, with Gordon Brown on Europe, and he said, in effect, that the Tories couldn't keep their pledge to end inheritance tax for estates of less than £1 million. Now, this is a very, very important pledge indeed. It will cost billions and billions to the Treasury at a time when the Treasury needs billions and billions. But when it was announced a year and a half ago at the Tory conference, it showed an immediate huge rise in Tory standing in the polls. It turned George Osborne into a Conservative Party hero. They will be very, very loath to get rid of this promise. Or is it a promise? Ken Clark said on Sunday that it was an aspiration. That's political talk for something we'd like to do, but we know perfectly well we can't. Then Alan Duncan, the shadow leader of the House, said, well, what we actually meant was that we will introduce it at some time in the first Conservative administration, I hoping that if they get in next year in 2010, things will look a lot better in 2015 when they have to go to the country again. David Cameron, meanwhile, he said, we made a promise and we're going to keep to that promise. And he already wants to talk to civil servants about how they can implement it very speedily when they get into power. So Ken Clark has rather landed them in it once again. And that's a real problem for David Cameron. He needs Clark's experience. He needs the fact that the public trusts him and thinks that he was a great chancellor, or certainly a lot better than any we've had lately. And someone who would be able to help bring us out of the muck we're in if the Tories come back in the government. But at the same time, Ken Clark is someone who tends to say what he means and tends to say what he thinks, and he's no more likely to stop doing that than he is to stop bird spotting, listening to jazz, or watching his beloved Nottingham Forest football club.
Debs, you talked about class war before you came in. What are they doing sticking to this policy?
I think it's really interesting, this inheritance tax pledge by the Tories, because actually a lot of people get really worked up about this, but most estates, and I mean by far the large majority of estates, never pay any inheritance tax. I mean, the threshold is 325,000, I think, now, isn't it? And so that means you've really got to have quite a valuable house or other assets in order to pay it. And yet it reflects a sort of aspirational view that house prices have been going up so steadily for 10 years when they made it. Obviously, they're going down now. But people think, oh, well, I don't pay it, but I might do if my house keeps going up. I can't understand how the Tories gained so much popularity by making this pledge in the first place. I really think it's a complete non-issue. What do you think, Polly?
Paul nodding.
I know exactly how they did it, because Labour said nothing. Labour allowed this head of steam to build up. There was a huge campaign going on in the Daily Express, and I have to say, to our shame, in The Observer too, saying it's the most unfair death tax. They were all sounding like George Bush. And Labour was sort of fixed in the headlights, didn't dare say anything, and should have stepped forward and said, absolute rubbish, only 6% of people pay this, and they're very, very rich. Don't you imagine, because your house is rising in value to 200,000 sort of average, it'll, because by the time you die, you will probably have spent some of that money. And anyway, the threshold will keep rising. It'll never be more than 6%.
But Julian, there were different times. It was September 2007. We probably both remember that party conference very well. George Osborne got Parliamentarian of the Year because of it, and it's even thought to have been why GB decided no election now. This is disastrous. But you must have picked up on rumblings that the Tories themselves are nervous about this.
Yes, I mean, there's two theories about Ken Clark. One is that he's a deeply inexperienced politician who didn't know what he was saying and who just stumbled in and just told the truth. Well, I think that's a bit unlikely. He's been doing this for 25 years. So the other Ken Clark is the person who goes into the studio and probably went a bit further in his language, but expressed doubts that he personally has and that discussions that are going on inside the party. They know they can't afford this. They're less worried than Polly about the justice and the inequality of it, because they're Tories and they don't find that a huge problem. But they know there is a problem there, because this is a big boon to the very rich and not to everybody else. The other problem is it was just very well known from that party conference, and ditching it is a public thing. They've got all sorts of other policies they can ditch because nobody can remember what they are. This one is a high-profile policy, and they've got a choice between adapting policy to circumstance and looking strong and consistent. And politicians need to do a bit of both of that in opposition and in government, but you do need to look like you're consistent sometimes.
The sort of arguments they've put out as to why they're sticking to them is that, you know, house prices are diminishing and so therefore, you know, it's not going to cost the exchequer quite so much. That sounds like monopoly economics to me.
Well, I know. Well, in that case, why bother? You know, it's just weird.
I think what might have happened as well is that they may have moved away from it, but Ken has now made it harder. Yeah, by saying this, they had to say something on Sunday night. Ken apparently wasn't available, so they couldn't get him to go out again. One wonders where he might have been.
Watching Formula One.
I think he's probably watching Formula One or some football. No, Formula One hadn't started then.
But Polly, the reason why us in the lobby got excited was that we had a series of speeches from Cameron in which he repositioned their party, and one of the things he said was the wealthy will also have to pay their quotes fair share. It's of a piece.
Well, what's interesting is that neither of the political parties have really understood the extent to which they are free to throw off their chains to say, times have changed beyond anything we could have imagined in 07. They can change any policy they want if they frame it in the right way and say, facts change, I change my mind, what do you do? And they can do it about this, and Labour can do it about top tax and say, no, we're not going to wait till after the election for a pathetic 45%. We're going to do it now because it's necessary, as Deborah said. I mean, everybody is free to react properly, responsibly, to listen to the public mood. And none of them are doing it. It's very curious.
I find that really, really interesting as well. I can't understand. There is no channel for public anger. There is no politician articulating what a lot of the people are feeling. And there is no real alternative to a return to growth at all costs.
I mean, you were talking about this earlier. Someone like Vince is sort of seen to be. But actually, if you look at what he's saying, he's not really there either.
No, I mean, we had a period when Vince was the great hero. He still is a great hero. He's a wonderful man. He's a fascinating person. But he's completely inconsistent as well. He's certainly not set out a clear policy. Even this week, we had Vince Cable in the House of Commons standing in for Nick Clegg, saying the government had a coup d'etat against it because it was trying to sell too much debt. This is the same Vince Cable who wants the government to be selling debt in order to expand the stimulus. So if he doesn't want them to sell gilts, he's got to work out how to get the money somehow. So he's pretty inconsistent, and he isn't the voice of anger. We do have to be a bit careful about wanting anger to be channeled into politics. It's not always very nice. There was a man called Oswald Mosley in the 1930s who tried to do that in Britain, in Depression.
One of the problems is that you get men like Oswald Mosley, or indeed the BNP, doing very well if politicians fail to catch the mood of the moment. If conventional politics misses it.
If the mainstream is not saying it, then you have to leave it to the extremists.
Can I go back to that point? It just, is the Prime Minister being in Brazil a good way to get the voice of the country channeled through mainstream politics? I don't think so.
Come back, Gordon, come back. Well, that's it for now. We'll be back on Friday the 3rd with an immediate take on the G20. Will Gordon emerge in one piece? Thanks to Julian Glover, Deborah Hargreaves and Polly Toynbee. As always, Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. Tom Clark will be back with me and you on the 3rd for that G2 special. But for now, see you.